Welcome to VMN Volume 3, Episode 19. The date is August 23rd, 2023. VMN is produced and transmitted from unceded Abenaki territory of so-called Vermont. Today we will be talking with Clee Benally about trouble with the police in Flagstaff, Arizona. We are talking about this in the light of the recent arrest of Epona Rose in a self-defense action. Clee Benally is a Diné, Navajo musician, traditional dancer, artist, filmmaker, and indigenous anarchist. He currently lives in Flagstaff, Arizona. Clee is originally from Black Mesa and has worked nearly all his life at the front lines in struggles to protect indigenous sacred lands. Clee provides strategic planning and direct action training with Indigenous Action Media and is currently the national coordinator of Clean Up the Mines. Clee helped established Tala Hugan Info Shop, Protect the Peaks, Out of Your Backpack Media, and volunteers with Howl No. Clee has produced numerous documentaries and facilitated strategic planning for social and environmental justice campaigns. He was the founder of Indigenous Action in 2001. Welcome, Clee.
Sorry with that long bio. I thought you were going to read a shortened version. Yeah, don't let those like that activisty sounding portfolio get in the way of a good conversation. And thank you for having me. Yate.
Thank you. And I'm delighted to meet you and to find out about you. I didn't know you until this unfortunate incident. And I've also come to enjoy your music too. So can you talk to me about what is happening in Flagstaff? I mean, I hear this about Epona. I read the police report and I'm horrified by how the police, even in the basic report, treated her. What is going on in Flagstaff?
Yeah, I mean, you sort of frame this as the trouble with police in Flagstaff. It's the trouble with police everywhere, policing and state violence and state repression, which has only escalated. And as you know, indigenous people who've been resisting colonial occupation and resource colonialism for generations now, we continue to face colonial violence by, you know, facing occupation and the extreme racism that continues to uphold this settlement of so-called Flagstaff. But I mean, we have to look, you know, step back and look at the context of the politics of so-called Arizona and understand that legislatively there have been attempts to annihilate trans existence. And what has happened with Epona here is an example of sort of the culmination of fear-mongering, of anti-trans violence, cis-heteropatriarchal, reactionary, you know, fragile fascists who are being emboldened and attacking trans people on the street for simply existing. And this is an outrage, but it's an example of how toxic the politics have been and continue to be. So we are mobilizing to fight back, of course, and to free Epona. But there is a context of police violence and state repression specifically here. And it's interesting in Arizona that some people look at this, you know, what we call Kinflene for Diné people, but it's known as occupied area of Flagstaff. They look at it as sort of a liberal, almost island, but that doesn't really mean anything. Because just below the surface, we have faced administratively sanctioned cultural genocide. The city of Flagstaff maintains a contract to sell 180 million gallons of treated sewage effluent. So basically the shit water that is flushed from the small town here of about 70,000 people. And it's a university town too. So there's, you know, people always coming and going. And so all the toilets here that are flushed That water is processed and then piped to a 14.8-mile pipeline up the San Francisco Peaks, which is a mountain held holy to 13 indigenous nations. Like, so when I say it's held holy, it's central to the ways of our being for many indigenous people. And so the city of Flagstaff sanctioned that. They have a contract to sell the wastewater to a ski resort to make snow. And then they profit off of that, and they subsidize actually the cost of that wastewater as well. So the city has shit all over indigenous cultures and has sanctioned the killing of our people. And we've resisted, of course, and we've faced political and state repression because of it. I've been arrested many times in the fight to protect this mountain. And I share that as a starting point, as an example of what we've faced. You know, we've been attacked in the streets for standing up for cultural survival as indigenous people here by the cops. And we've been harassed and given, you know, death threats by fascists who want to further colonial domination, not see indigenous people challenge that. And then the other component, the other dynamic is that the city of Flagstaff, if you look at the police records for the past decade, the annual police reports state that out of about 7,000 people arrested each year, and this is rough numbers, half of those people are indigenous. Yet out of 70,000 people, we only make up 10% of the population. So if you do the numbers, that's about 7,000 indigenous people residing here. So if half of the population of those who are arrested each year, 7,000, half of that, that represents one in every two indigenous people that live here face arrest every year in this community. So the extreme racial profiling, the disproportionate level of arrests is embedded in the racial state violence that we continue to face through the ongoing colonial occupation here. And the gendered component, the cis-heteropatriarchal component, is absolutely part of that and what we now face with, you know, this case of Epona. But we've also faced it before in, let's see, in 2021, a trans indigenous organizer who's a great friend of mine, I work with them with Indigenous Action, named Bon, was targeted and arrested while they were mobilizing a protest against police violence that had been waged against an unsheltered indigenous person. You know, there was camera footage or witnesses and folks who documented police brutalizing an unsheltered relative. So a protest was mobilized, and then you know, this trans indigenous organizer was targeted and arrested with felony charges, and there was mobilization to address that as well. And there we can provide a range of examples that are probably very similar stories to many other communities, because of course policing isn't just a problem in Flagstaff or Arizona, but it's wherever police exist. And that's why we, of course, say all cops are bastards.
What became of the case in 2021?
Ultimately, there was a plea deal. You can check out the updates on our website, indigenousaction.org. But yeah, the community, part of the community rallied, part of the community didn't. You know, like any, you know, radical community, there's a lot of fragmentation, especially small communities. But yeah, we've just mobilized our crews and made sure that we supported our trans relative and fought and continue to make sure that, you know, it's understood that when trans folks are under attack, we're going to step up and fight back and make sure it's unacceptable. And so, yeah, I mean, there's a range of other cases. You know, we've had unsheltered relatives who were shot by police in the region. One of the most noted cases in nearby Winslow, Arizona, which is a so-called border town. You have to understand, like, that the geopolitical dynamics here is that Flagstaff is considered a border town to reservation communities because it's right outside of the Navajo Nation, which is the largest reservation in the so-called U.S. It's about roughly the size of West Virginia, with a population of about 300,000 people or so residing on it. And there's the Hopi Rez, there's Havasupai, Hualapai, there's a range of bands of Apache around the area as well. And so it's considered a border town, but I don't call it a border town because it's stolen occupied lands. And Winslow is also a border town, not too far by. And some years ago, the police there gunned down L'Oreal Sinigini, a single Diné mom who was accused of shoplifting. And one narrative says she fought back with scissors. The other narrative is that, you know, she was just outright attacked by aggressive white police officer. And that sent resounding impacts, you know, of course, throughout the region, and people mobilized just to ensure that there's a strong, fierce community response to police violence.
I've been sending a lot of public records requests to the city of Flagstaff and Coconino County. On the surface, the reaction I get is they're all very liberal. They're all very nice. Can you talk about the phenomenon of having the nice liberal face in the government and then having the brutal occupying police? Can you talk a little bit about this phenomenon?
Yeah, and I'll try to share a story, so maybe it's more anecdotal, but you know, for years we've been fighting for Indigenous Peoples Day to be celebrated as an act of anti-colonial resistance in the face of the celebration, outright celebration of Christopher Columbus. And that process became deteriorated and co-opted with the sort of popular movements of land acknowledgments and Indigenous Peoples Day. And we always asserted that our fight for Indigenous Peoples Day was an anti-colonial position, and that also demanded accountability and a range of other things. And so I won't go into the details of the organizing around that. But what I will say is that ultimately that the process of liberal co-optation of embracing Indigenous Peoples Day without accountability. So, you know, the city of Flagstaff is, as I mentioned, maintaining a contract based on cultural genocide of our people to desecrate a sacred mountain with treated sewage and profiteering off of it. And they make a pronouncement of Indigenous Peoples Day as extraordinarily hypocritical. And so we challenged them on that. And because that was part of the condition of us saying, yeah, you want to celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day? End your contract. And then end your anti-homeless laws. And let's start there and then go beyond and see what the community wants is accountability, which, you know, for us is a fight for total liberation of our lands and peoples and non-human beings in this area. But yeah, so we held a demonstration back in when this designation happened in 2018. We had like 100 people mobilized in the streets of Flagstaff. We took the streets, and you know, there's a range of issues that we were addressing. And the police targeted us, of course. They were aggressively physical with people, and they didn't arrest anybody at the demonstration, but they did a targeted operation of extreme surveillance. They went through social media feeds. They followed people. They surveilled people at their work, their homes, etc. And after a few weeks of investigation, they charged over 11 people, including one person with a felony. And so ultimately, three of us resisted those charges, including myself. The rest of the folks accepted a plea deal because it was part of a condition where they were going to drop the felony down to a misdemeanor if other folks accepted the plea deal. And three of us were like, you know, fuck this shit. We're going to fight, you know, and this is like, how more deeply hypocritical is this city if on Indigenous Peoples Day, Indigenous peoples are demonstrating and then they're targeted with mass surveillance and further repression. So you want to talk about a liberal city? No. you want to talk about ongoing Indigenous genocide? That's what we're facing, and that's what's being covered by this whitewashed facade of land acknowledgments, hollow land acknowledgments, and you know what ends up being is this sort of performative celebration of so-called Indigenous Peoples Day, when the ongoing violations of our existence persist every single day in this community. I work with unsheltered people with Kintlani Mutual Aid, which is a mutual aid project that rose up out of the Talahuan Info Shop, which was established back in 2007. And so, you know, we've been providing mutual aid for Indigenous folks on the streets here and other folks, of course, but the largest population here of unsheltered people is Indigenous. And they face the most extreme police violence that largely goes unreported, because who's going to hold the cops accountable when they're enforcing state-sanctioned violence, because the city of Flagstaff has an anti-camping ordinance. So it's illegal to sleep for Indigenous people on our lands. I could tell you story after story working with Indigenous people for that long on the streets who have faced extreme to the point of being shot by cops here in this community. So you want to talk about liberalism? Let's talk about what liberalism always implies in its base level in the context of ongoing colonial occupation is just further political ongoing violence against Indigenous peoples. And part of that is also the sort of like whitewashing or rainbow washing or rainbow capitalism or co-optation of any, you know, free expression of those who are alienated. And trans folks clearly are being targeted on these streets, and then further, I don't want to say victimized, but face further violence through the process of being held captured and held behind bars. You're aware of, and I think your audience should be more aware of, with Epona's case, they have been going through extreme gendered violence while behind bars.
Is there anything more you can say? There's a concept called recuperation when when there's a radical movement that challenges the state, and then the state in turn co-opts the basic demands of it and then neuters the movement. Can you say anything more about that process and about how you face it out in your part of the world?
Yeah, I mean, recuperation or co-optation is nothing new. It's been a factor since the, you know, Red Power movement for Indigenous people since the 60s, and of course the Black Power and movements, and you know, radical student organizing, and we can go on throughout the movement histories, complex movement histories of so-called U.S. And the state, you know, weaponizes its means to control any kind of radical agitation and provocation or existence to bring it in line or, you know, under domination. And so the factors here are just what I said, you know, with Indigenous Peoples Day, because it was a radical. Today you can go to an Indigenous Peoples event and they don't talk about colonialism. That's obscene, because celebrating Indigenous peoples, not just for one day, means recognizing that our fight for liberation is ongoing. And if we're just turning it into a marketing scheme, which is the recuperation component of capitalism, the logics of capitalism and colonial exploitation, just consume, you know, and turn these moments into commodities or into theatrical performances with nothing meaningful. And this is something that, like, in so-called Canada, there's Indigenous academic by the name of Glenn Coulthard, who wrote a book called Redskins White Mask, which is it's sort of based off of Frantz Fanon's Black Skins White Masks. And he talks about the difference between the politics of recognition and the politics of liberation. Politics of recognition has us begging our colonizers to see our suffering and make changes within the system. where the politics of liberation is about, empowering our folks and empowering the connection to our lands and our ancestors for total liberation. But I'm not necessarily providing specific dynamics, but, whether it's the nonprofit industrial complex and our own people redwashing or whitewashing our struggles and just accepting any handouts that they get from begging colonizers for change, these dynamics persist everywhere and are dynamics that we're aware of, so we resist, and it's important to be critical and aware of them, but a lot of folks get subsumed by these shitty tactics that nonprofits and the state uses to immobilize and paralyze radical expression and existence and fight, resistance. I don't know if that answers your question, but in Flagstaff, it's an ongoing battle.
How difficult is it for people to defend themselves in Flagstaff? Is it a constant problem for marginalized people to be charged with felonies or misdemeanors when they defend themselves and their lives?
That's an interesting question. And I think, I don't feel like I have the experience and perspective as being an organizer in this community for over 20 years. But I don't feel like I have the position to answer that necessarily, because there's a lot of dynamics and a lot of, ways people are targeted. I can share specific experiences, I think. And I think that probably relates to the larger picture of what we sort of face as a new political environment of the sort of post 9/11 Patriot Act resistance or dissent as terrorism issue. I mean, we can go to the Green Scare as an example. Operation Backfire in 2005 or 6, waged by the FBI, that targeted alleged members of the Earth Liberation Front throughout the country. Well, one person was arrested here in Flag, one person arrested just south of here in Prescott. Bill Rogers, or AKA Avalon, was held here at the Coconino County Jail, and he allegedly took his life. He left a suicide note. He was a friend of mine too. But we view that as, the state murdering and extinguishing his life, and waging ongoing attacks and repression. So I think that political climate exists in many different ways. A lot of ground was gained during the George Floyd uprising with the powerful expressions of Black Lives Matter. I think that was, and it still is, a space where people are more comfortable taking the streets. But, back in 2011 or 12 here, when we were doing a demonstration, marching through the streets off and on with 150 people or so, we were, just targeted and arrested and charged for being in the streets. And some people were pulled off the sidewalk and brutalized by cops. Like, it was a mass arrest situation. And today, though, because of the ground gained by the George Floyd uprising, we can have 100 people marching in the streets, or 20 people marching in the streets, and the cops sort of back down a little bit. But then they, proceed with their tactics. I think that there's ground gain and fought hard for, but the sort of status quo of state violence exists. There's always the threat of state violence and ongoing state surveillance as well. So it is, the question is it hard to resist? It's hard to fight back anywhere. In terms of frontline, we can look at the state repression and private militarized forces in Standing Rock as an extreme example, but something that, has then proceeded to be employed as a tactic of the state and corporate mercenaries in Line 3 or other frontlines camps as well, to target, isolate people, and you know, surveil them with extreme technological, you know, advanced weaponry. We had another young Diné person who was targeted during the pandemic, and during the George Floyd uprising. He was up in so-called Page, another so-called border town here around Dnepr, the Navajo Nation, and his name is Lauren Reed. He was just making some private Facebook comments about, you know, doing some radical actions in the community. And a few days later, the law enforcement agencies raided and arrested him very sensationally. And he sat in prison because of the, you know, the whole stasis of what was happening during the pandemic. He sat in prison for like 2 years, I think, waiting trial. And he was facing decades in prison for just a private conversation that he had on Facebook, or Fedbook, as everybody calls it. I think that there's like a challenges to resist, challenges to organize, but, you know, we're creative and we're smart. There's also not just the threat of state violence, there's the threat of fascist violence as well, that we have to contend with. And that's, you know, a dynamic factor of what occurred with Epona's situation as well, with, you know, resisting a fascist assault, not calling the cops, and then facing the severe severity of state violence because of that.
You mentioned surveillance. I remember at Standing Rock, there was a government contractor called Tiger Swan that was doing the surveillance. There's also somewhere close to where you are, there's a company called Stratfor that was targeted by anti-sec, LulzSec. Jeremy Hammond took an arrest, was arrested for hacking Stratfor. Is there any evidence that these Stratfor or Tiger Swan are behind some of the surveillance that you're facing? Have you figured out who's the contractor doing it?
So we have a dynamic that is sort of post 9/11 fusion centers, which are a multi-agency collaborative law enforcement arrangements, where it's like the feds, the state, county, cops, tribal cops will all, you know, be part of this information and strategic sharing system. And they maintain a database, they track people, they, you know, we have, there was, as part of like the, I think maybe connected to this with like Anonymous and a lot of the hacktivism that was primarily occurring several years back, we found records of infiltration at events that we were hosting at the Talawan Info Shop and other places with surveillance. And, you know, at one point the Fusion Centers put out a bulletin alert of anarchist extremist activity in Arizona specifically, and naming some of the groups that we're associated with. So the private contractors we see more or less on the borders of so-called US and Mexico, with the militarization of the border and the extreme surveillance that the indigenous communities who live in lands that are bisected by these colonial lines have continued to be faced with. I mean, just recently, just a few months ago, a Tohono O'odham person was gunned down by Border Patrol agents. So yeah, this is an ongoing threat and an ongoing reality that is part of the surveillance machine, because behind it is always, you know, the eye looking to enact violence by the state.
Going back,
but no direct links between Tiger Swan that we're aware of, because the corporations that, the small corporations that we've resisted here, I think, with resource extractive attacks and sacred lands and so forth, have primarily relied on either the Forest Service, so it's like Fed, you know, action right away, or the county and other municipal law enforcement agencies, but they've had like the full support of those resources in the struggles that we've faced.
Getting back to Epona's case, she has been treated really badly at the Coconino County Jail. I mean, I've experienced some good jails and some bad jails. DC jail was one of the better ones. The Philly Roundhouse, well, that was one of the worst ones. Is the Coconino County Jail on the realm of like a DC cop jail, or is it more like what we see in the Fulton County Jail on the scale of bad to utter hell? Where is it?
I don't think it's fair to apply a kind of metric rating system to treatment at jail, because state violence is state violence. Being locked against your will when you are caged for defending your existence is something that no one should face, and is certainly a degrading process, because that's part of, right, the psychological warfare waged by the state to strip our morale, to strip our fighting spirit. So yeah, I mean, you know, I can share my own experiences and stories. I don't know if they're helpful, but at some point all these jails or prisons have the same dynamics, and I don't think some kind of rating system makes sense to apply, because state violence is state violence, and people react differently too, right? Some folks who have a lot more experience would react differently than a young person who feels very vulnerable, or maybe, you know, a juvenile who, like, you know, somebody under 18 who has different vulnerabilities, or, you know, is in a different, you know, emotional or mental health state, you know, would react differently. Maybe one day they'd be strong, maybe not. You know, I think the question is really is how resolved our movement is to make sure that we get our people free, that we send the message to support them, share our love and respect and honor them in a way that makes sure that they recognize that our acts of solidarity can be as meaningful as they can be, considering the situation, until we can break our people out. And that's a big challenge. But yeah, I mean, opponents' experience is something that they're relaying and they're sharing, and it's a crisis that they're facing. The longer they're in jail, the longer they're at risk, because they, from the moment of police interaction, clearly they were undermined, as their trans existence was undermined and weaponized against them, and that seems to be what's happening. As long as they're every day that they're incarcerated, we hear conditions are getting better, but what does that mean? You know, when you're subject to capture or being caged like that. So it's hard for me to respond to that question, because I think it brings up a lot of other questions that, you know, I'm not, you know, it's like a jail could have a fucking, you know, be greenwashed and have a nice composting system. Does it change the fact that they, you know, still represent the carceral state, the extreme ongoing violence and systemic oppression and control and domination and economic exploitation of our peoples? Like, hell no.
You've said you've fought cases in Flagstaff against these authorities. Are you able to share any of these experiences? Are there lessons we can take from them? I admire that you've not laid down and just taken a plea on what you've talked about.
I don't know. I'm not really keeping track how many times I've been arrested here. And sometimes I have taken pleas with, you know, principled stands, like with Indigenous people at stake. It was something that I wasn't willing to plea at all on a principled level. And I was prepared to accept whatever consequences, because this, I'm not going to go negotiate with the state. You know, it's a challenging place to be when you're forced and faced to confront your own survival, though, right? So it's just a question of weighing the consequences. If it's a misdemeanor or felony, it's a different response. I'll share this story. And I'm trying not to toot my own horn, but we did an action, a very low level theatrical action at the Forest Service headquarters here for the Coconino National Forest, which manages the San Francisco Peaks, is captured stolen land, and they are the primary agency that has sanctioned the desecration of the mountain here. And so we delivered a letter essentially on the same day. This is, I think, 2012, same day that the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which is in charge of the Forest Service, was finalizing or ended the comments, I think, comment period for the draft of a new policy regarding sacred sites protection. So like this fight, you know, has been an international fight and has put a lot of pressure on different levels of the federal government and local administration and so forth, as a, you know, an example of quote unquote extreme human rights abuses. And so we delivered a letter to, and we went into the lobby of the Forest Service, delivered a letter with a range of different demands or positions, really. And there were some folks who were dressed in hazmat suits with caution tape. So they sort of quarantine, which is a theatrical action that we've done previously because of the hazardous chemicals in the wastewater that they would be spraying on the Sacred Mountain. And at the end of the action, somebody tipped over a bucket of what was marked as wastewater. And so, and everybody left. You know, it was not that spectacularly controversial of an action or confrontational of an action. You know, there was not a lockdown. There was just, you know, here's a letter. We're going to occupy your lobby for X amount of time until you tell us to leave, then we'll leave. And we did. Somebody just, you know, pushed over this bucket filled with this substance. And so the hazmat team was called in. And after months of investigation, we found out, we were tipped off by a local journalist that there were unsealed warrants out for the arrest of four people, including myself. And one of the people was facing a terrorism enhancement charge. And so for their alleged role of, you know, tipping over this unknown substance of alleged wastewater. And so they were preparing a raid of us, and it was going to be sensational, of course. And this was weeks before the ski area, after decades of battles to stop this development, to stop desecration of this mountain legally, administratively, with every procedure, process, meeting at the UN, appealing to everybody, petitioning, marching, doing everything that we could, right? Going up to the Supreme Court. The ski resort, within weeks of this action, or the point where they were going to raid us, was preparing to make snow for the first time on the mountain. So they were doing construction. And so the bulldozers were getting ready to start. No, they had already started. They were just getting ready to start pumping the wastewater through the pipelines. And we had already done a range of other actions with mass arrests and so forth. And so we stole their thunder. We turned ourselves in. There was only one person that they couldn't locate. That's why they were holding off on the raids. And you know, we showed up, and I'll make this short because I've already made it long. I ended up, you know, in me and the two other people that I was with who turned ourselves in, ended up in shackles, you know, around our waist, with the cuffs to our shackles, with our feet shackled. You know, it was federal charges. So they take things a little bit more seriously. And we were before a judge, and the judge, as a condition of my release, was trying to ban me and others from going anywhere on the national forest public lands, because they were afraid that we were going to, you know, fuck shit up and try to stop the ski resort from making wastewater for the first time, wastewater snow for the first time. And yeah, they threatened us. They threatened me with the incarceration till trial if I attempted to do anything. You know, and when we, because we said, my lawyer said, if they ban me from going to the peaks, that would infringe upon my religious expression, which is true. You know, it's not a legal thing. It's just this mountain is our church. by the colonizer's law, that would break their own laws. And so the judge just looked at me, threatened me, and said, well, this is an act of subterfuge. If you're using essentially your religious freedom as a way to undermine what the court is trying to do, then we're going to put you in prison until your trial. So yeah, I don't know if that helps to shed light on what we're facing, but this is an ongoing attack, not just against indigenous people, but those who stand for freedom, who stand for dignity in the face of white supremacy, cis-heteropatriarchy, colonial violence, and capitalism that we continue to face. And it's escalating. Their tactics change and get in and adapt with technology, but we also adapt as well. And we are more creative and try to make sure that we support those who face these attacks and who are captured by the state and who face ongoing state violence inside and outside.
Sorry for that long story. Oh, it's fine. We need to fill up the hour somehow.
No, don't tell me that. I'll keep talking. But yeah, and this isn't just my experience. Like I that's why I said I don't want to tomorrow. We had, we've had, I don't know how many arrests, more than 50 people arrested during one, campaign action span, and, many other arrests, and a lot of people arrested during the George Floyd uprising, and a lot of, treatment, severe mistreatment, especially of youth in the detention facility here. And, I know a lot of and organized with a lot of unsheltered relatives who they cycle in and out of the jail. Sometimes, they get caught up in the court system legally because, one, there's an anti-camping ordinance here. So where do folks go? And the shelters have been discriminatory and violent against Indigenous people here. So where do they go? And so they get arrested and then they get charges piling up, and it becomes this endless vicious cycle that holds them, within and behind and locked up and beneath and away, disappeared. So the liberal facade, the liberal gaze doesn't want to see that. I've been to city council meetings here where people, city council members said that, they wouldn't want a dog pissing on their yard. So why would they have Indigenous people, being able to camp and piss wherever they want? So equating our people to dogs. So that's the mentality of the liberals that run this town. But yeah, the unsheltered people that I talk with, there was one person who I worked with for years who was on the street, and he's very well known. He was attacked by some white kids in a racist anti-homeless attack some years ago. And the police actually put out a statement saying that, undermining his credibility, and shared his arrest history. They publicly, this is unprecedented in this community, they publicly said that he basically was he was victimized by the cops publicly and had no recourse, of course, and he was behind bars for a month. And so I talked to him almost every day, if you go to the Coconino County Jail, you will see probably about 90%, 95% of the people behind bars are Indigenous people. Yet we only make up about 10% of a community of 70,000 people. So that's what we face. And, I can relay a range of stories and mistreatment, but it's the reality. Like I, as a direct action organizer, I try to make sure people, the point of our direct actions usually is not to get arrested, because we don't want to feed people into the carceral state and subject them to further violence, not just in the arrest process, not just in jail, but also, through the court process and system. That's, especially with the kind of usual economic violence that's waged by levying like fines or restitution and all that kind of shit. The treatment's always bad. It's never good to be behind bars. We always want our people free.
Tennessee enacted an anti-camping ban that makes it a literal felony to camp on public property. What are the details of the Flagstaff anti-camping laws? Is it that severe?
It's not a felony, but that's it's not surprising, I guess, considering the lengths that people will go to criminalize sleep, to make sleep a crime. But that is, wow, what a threat, right? What a threat of violence for those who are at most risk, those who have faced so much loss and suffering and who are destitute, the most, you know, quote unquote, wretched of folks, living without shelter, you know, facing for whatever circumstances in their life due to, you know, whatever reasons, doesn't matter. But then just always have that threat of further state violence is, yeah, that's, but that's, yeah, I mean, here, anti-camping ordinance is a misdemeanor, but it also applies to people sleeping in their cars. So, you know, it's the contradiction of this community is that when floods happen or when wildfires happen, they immediately open up emergency shelters at schools or community centers for housed people, right? They've excluded unsheltered people. And during the winter, we get very harsh winters here. Almost every winter, someone on the street passes due to exposure. And we organize with our mutual aid crews, and there's some other crews in this community that organize street patrols to make sure that people don't freeze or have the necessary items to survive if they want to try to rough it. Or we get them hotel rooms, or we, you know, get them housed other ways, take them to the shelters and so forth. Yeah, but that is, these kinds of municipalities are willing to sacrifice people who are extremely destitute, and subject them to further violence, and non-existence. I mean, that's really what these laws say, is we don't want you to exist here. So where then do we exist, especially if we're Indigenous people? You know, because my relative who was incarcerated for about a month here or more, in so-called Flagstaff, who's an organizer and relative on the street, his name is Shane Russell, and he stated at one of the rallies that we had, because we had a protest here organized by unsheltered people, and because of how bad the conditions have been. And he says that before 1492, no one was homeless on these lands. It's not a unique dynamic. This exists in many places. You just have to look below the surface and the facade. And there's usually a lot of whitewashing and window dressing and performative political theatrics.
And I'm about 2 hours from Burlington, Vermont, and that's supposedly one of the most liberal cities in the country, and it's gotten worse and worse for homeless people in Burlington. They had a homeless camp that was fairly safe. They had micro houses built, but they had to raid it and kick everyone out on the street and build half a dozen micro houses, and they say they've fixed it. So yeah, it happens here too.
Oh yeah, and in so-called Phoenix or occupied Ocamil, Autumn, and Pepash lands, just south of 2.5 hours south of here, the city was raiding and clearing unsheltered encampments or homeless encampments during that extreme massive heat wave, and people were dying on the streets. Fascists were cutting water lines and slashing water barrels. I mean, this, you know, a society should be judged based upon how it treats those most destitute, those most vulnerable, those most risk at harm. And this is clear evidence of how this society, this social order, dominant social order, needs to be done away with.
It's going to be, when Epona's case comes up to trial, this is it, the people who attacked her, that's going to be a crux of it. What is the nature of the violence that happens on the street in Flagstaff? Is it fascist, or is it just people who are desperate and out of their minds? What are we seeing mostly?
You know, it's hard for me to comment on, because I think there's a constant state of the threat of violence wherever colonial occupation exists, especially against those who are most vulnerable. And in the climate, in the context of the political climate of so-called Arizona, that means trans, queer folks are in the sights of people who have these hostilities that have been whipped up by conservative pundits you know, they're constantly barraged by media channels that reinforce a bias of alienation and transphobia, the xenophobia that, you know, came out of the surface forward, you know, during the Trump administration was always there. That violence persists. I have uncles that were murdered in border towns, and those cases were never solved. Speculations are that there were what a dynamic that is known, and there's a name for it here, that used to be called Indian rolling, of white people attacking, you know, what they perceived as drunk or homeless indigenous people. So that's nothing new for us. We've continued to face this on different levels. And you know, I think identity politics and multiculturalism, like, you know, the analysis is hard to make when society has, you know, put the weapons in everybody's hands and hearts and minds. You know, indigenous people are just, you know, we face violence in our own communities by those who are assimilated. There's a lot of, we can't just look at Native people as a monolith or other people as monoliths and expect good treatment. It can happen anywhere. You know, it's just like speculating, how is the violence and who's doing more of the violence at different places? Well, it's in a, you know, we live in a context of threat of ongoing violence because of our existence, whether it be because, you know, we're indigenous, trans, black, migrants, you know, and so forth. So, you know, I can't say, and I don't, you know, I don't know the assailants. I think that information will come out soon. Those who, I don't even like the term assailants. It sounds too clinical and removed. Those who, you know, enacted fascist violence against, you know, or anti-trans violence against Epona, you know, we'll figure that out. We'll find out what happened as the case unfolds. And right now things are fairly closed for good reason, you know, because of the way that the state manipulates and the way that the right-wing conservatives most likely are going to sort of pounce on this as an example and try to make an example of someone like Epona. I mean, fuck, look what they're doing to beer cans. I mean, holy shit, you know, and that's just metaphorical, right? They are just seeing that as a metaphor and stand-in for actual murdering actual trans people. You know, we've absolutely faced a range of different kinds of violence, direct, you know, I mean, just being an organizer in a small town like this, I've faced, you know, death threats and been followed and, you know, that kind of shit. And we've, you know, had out and out, like, you know, anti-fascist confrontations and so forth. So, you know, we've had fascists pull the guns on us, you know, at demonstrations downtown. So,
it's pretty dire.
Yeah. But the flip side is that we're also organizing, you know, we mobilize our folks and, you know, it's not just this pat, like, I mean, the liberal reaction is to pacify and to, you know, sort of turn the other cheek kind of politics, which is utter bullshit. You know, we need community and collective and self-defense. We need to embolden and fucking train, you know, skill up our people, because it's going to continue to get worse. You know, I think the anti-trans fervor that has been whipped up by the conservative right, you know, is it's deadly, very deadly. And we have to brace ourselves in different ways, but not just as a defense, but be offensive too. To, you know, to me, like, all the organizing regarding mutual aid also implies mutual defense. You know, and I think those go hand in hand. You know, we can do mutual aid by day and anti-fascism by night, or sometimes at the same time. And there's brilliant also, like, celebrations of that and ways that people have organized, mobilized, you know, from organizing, you know, gun clubs to just doing street actions for self-defense and collective defense as well. And just establishing networks of support, radical care, and intervening when necessary, being ready to mobilize. And that's what we're doing right now in this community. We've mobilized before for a range of other struggles, and it's unfortunate that we have to do this for Epona, but that's the reality that we continue to face, and it's better to have these networks in place and the experience there, so it doesn't keep happening again, because we want to stop the violence before it occurs.
While I was waiting for you to sign on to the Zoom room, I was talking with one of the Vermont state de-escalators about how we can't just be thinking about de-escalating, because one of these days there's going to be people coming who are not going to de-escalate. And we have to think honestly and forthrightly about community self-defense.
We can multitask too, like prepare with skills of de-escalation, but fucking train up and skill up for with skills of self-defense and collective defense as well. I think that they should not be mutually exclusive. And if they are, we're just fucking kidding ourselves about the nature of ongoing cis hetero patriarchal white supremacist colonial and capitalist violence.
I don't think any of us want to hurt even a fascist. I don't want to end them. So we want to try to de-escalate things and maybe convert a heart or two. Oh,
my ancestors ended fascists. I don't have a problem with that.
Well, I don't have a problem with it, but I'd rather you'd rather have a chance of changing someone's heart if that's possible.
Yeah, I think that the heart of, you know, it gets into a deeper question of how that heart grows on stolen land, how it is cultivated, what is nourished by in this environment, and what needs to be undermined and destroyed to be able to, or composted, maybe that's a better term, to make room for more fertile grounds for better growth, health, and healing. Because, yeah, I mean, collective liberation should mean that we heal the wounds that exist within nature and all of existence. And, you know, I come from, you know, a people who have ancestry of warriors, and we have a warrior culture and ceremonies and prayers, and we carry our protection and our balance in both hands. And we have ceremonies for healing, but we also have ceremonies for defense. And that is a relationship older than time here, and is a relationship of harmony and balance. And that's what, you know, is the illusion of America, the illusion of wanting to perpetuate a project of colonial domination that is America will always be part of its legacy. That violence is rooted in its psyche and its heart, and it flows through its, I don't want to call it blood, but its oily veins.
I was going to talk a little bit about a friend who's a homeless person that I helped get housed. I've known him for 40 years. I met him at a protest for Puerto Rican for liberation of Puerto Rican people. Actually, it was at one of the most renowned demonstrations in the country. It was the Hartford 1986 demonstration for political prisoners. And he had a very hard life. He ended up on the street, and I got him housing in so-called Vermont, and I got him internet access. When he got on the internet, the person who was stood up for liberation is now an anti-trans person. He insists there's no systemic racism. He swallowed all this far-right stuff. One of my friends always talks about, a Jewish friend talks about, does somebody have a fascist heart? I don't really understand how somebody who stood with ADAPT, I was arrested in Philly with him at a ADAPT demo, and he's now far right. It puzzles me how somebody changes like that, and whether it's something was wrong in their heart or they just went down a wrong path. I don't know what to think about. My wife always tells me to forget about it, but this is somebody I knew for almost 40 years.
It's hard to diagnose, but I think in the context of the saturation regarding corporate media in terms of the fear and scapegoating, it's not surprising to me, especially regarding a culture that is based upon a chauvinism that has created this civilization. I mean, if you look at the language that was all used to justify Manifest Destiny, it is the language of civilizing and civilization. And this chauvinism is embedded in the psyche and has produced, you know, who are called those who call themselves the Proud Boys. Just, you know, another way of expressing themselves as fascists. You know, if we understand fascism as racialized nationalism, extreme racialized authoritarian nationalism. So many people, like, you know, buy into the military sort of industrial narratives because the propaganda is extreme. It's extraordinary. The indoctrination, you know, people talk about liberal indoctrination. I mean, fuck, you know, we're not even there, you know, like with leftists really trying to overly indoctrinate people. The cultural roots, if we can call them that, of this project of America are a poison, you know, pill that people swallow as the first sort of understanding of so-called democracy. And that's in a legacy built upon enslavement of Black folks and genocide of Indigenous people and mass-scale land theft. So that's already within the psyche, you know, spiritually. I think you have to understand that so we can talk about the way the relationships of the mind, the heart, and the spirit and the body. And it's a holistic issue then, right? I think the reflex right now of fascists, authoritarian, you know, racially motivated nationalists in the so-called US, and it's a global dynamic, right? Is a reinforcement of that superiority dynamic, the domination dynamic, the control and exploitation dynamic that is deeply embedded in how people are brought up in the system and how they identify to be, you know, socially productive members of the society. That's why I say the society just needs to be done away with. It's hard to diagnose individuals as to what their disposition is, right? We can look at a range of demographics. I mean, I have relatives who are extremely conservative Christians. We have Zionist Diné people, you know, like, I mean, how the fuck does that happen? You know, what level of assimilation, you know, what level of post-colonialism is that? What stage are we at?
Yeah, we could probably talk for another 5 hours about the roots of fascism, but I think for tonight we've probably said it almost enough. So how do you want to close for tonight?
Well, hopefully we covered what you need to cover. I think it's important to close with just reinforcing the messaging and amplifying, broadcasting out Epona's struggle. So join us and support Epona and that, you know, the axiom of, you know, we're not free unless everyone's free. You know, it sounds cliche, but it's fucking true. And in the context of, you know, the onslaught of legislative annihilation and anti-trans attacks here in so-called Arizona, we need to have opponents back as fiercely as we can. And it's not just with Epona or any case that gets, you know, high profile, because how many more people are succumbing in the dark, in the shadows, under the veil of the thin veil of these liberal facades, right? Of some of these towns where we don't expect this to happen. No, it can happen anywhere because this is the status quo of the dominant social order that is pervasive throughout these occupied stolen lands. So, you know, fight the struggles where you're at, but, you know, do what you can to make sure we amplify, broadcast, and send solidarity and support for those who are captured by the state or held against their freedom. And we can support them in so many different creative and powerful ways.
And you can hear more about Epona's case at freeeponarose.org. And as an addendum to this web podcast, multiple people have died in the Coconino County Jail. Just look on Google or DuckDuckGo and you will find the reports. If you like this podcast, please consider sharing and liking it on your social media. Reviews help drive the algorithms that basically run the internet world. So if you have time, leave a review on your podcast aggregator. Reviews on Apple and Google help a lot. So if, and only if, you are willing to deal with those companies, leave reviews. If you don't, we understand. VMN was formerly known as Vermont Movement News and can be found on podcast apps as Vermont Movement News. Thank you.